Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend Jim Lutze, who was the longtime professor here of history here and the chair of the
Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense.
Curriculum in Peace,
mouthful.
War, and Defense curriculum, which has been so important to Chapel Hill, also as president of Hampton Sydney College in Virginia, and then again, longtime chancellor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. I remember him also as the host of a long-time running public television series quartered at UNC-TV called Globe Watch. He's now sort of in retirement, but maybe busier than ever. And I should say also a candidate for political office after his retirement from UNCW. Jim Lutze, welcome.
Glad to be here, DG.
You're not happy with the current political situation or the historical situation. So unhappy, in fact, that you've sat down and wrote a book called Entering North Carolina, Set Clocks Back 100 Years. What's it all about?
Well, my original title for the book is I'm Mad as Hell and I Want My State Back. But the publisher didn't think that was such a good idea. I am not a North Carolina historian, nor is this a work of original historical scholarship. I became very concerned, probably starting 10 years ago, when there was talk about undoing the New Deal. And I started thinking about, that's ridiculous, but they're not going to undo the New Deal. But after 2010 in North Carolina, I became convinced that people not only wanted to undo the New Deal, they wanted to get rid of the entire progressive era. They wanted to go back to the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century. And so I became convinced that people were taking seriously the idea of turning the clock back, getting rid of many of those things that we've become very familiar with in our society and most people very comfortable with. They want to change. And so I went back and looked at North Carolina history, and I looked at what had been going on in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century and well up into the middle of the 20th century. And I thought, this is the model. This is the roadmap they're following.
And what is that roadmap?
I don't want to get too deep into the history at the moment, but North Carolina was a very poor state. I mean, you have to realize that at the beginning of the 20th century, someone said North Carolina has the worst public education system in the country. By the 1950s, we were only 45th in per capita income out of 50 states. So North Carolina is not the progressive state that many people who came here in the 1960s and 70s thought it was. It was a very poor, very backward, and if I could say so, very racist state. And low taxes, low regulation, poor education, poor roads, not what you would really want to go back to. But I think what some people like is that you didn't have regulations and you didn't have blacks in positions of authority, and you didn't have women on the Supreme Court, and they would like to go back and get rid of those things.
What would the North Carolina, in their mind, look like as it is different both from what we had 5 or 6 years ago, or what would be different about it from what we've got today?
Well, I think if let's take an issue that certainly is near and dear to my heart, which is public schools. I am convinced that many people, and I call them redeemers, and I would be happy to say why.
Yeah, well, let's go. I do want you to do that.
Okay, why I call them redeemers.
But keep going on this
okay,
comparison
first. Okay, but this, first. A group. And I also want to make the point that I am not trying to be partisan. This is not about reelect Democrats. This is not about throw the Republicans out. We've had great Republican leadership in this state. Jim Holzhauser, as you know, wonderful chairman of the board of governors, a great governor, a thoughtful man. Jim Martin, also on the board of governors, and both of them were moderates. They changed. They got rid of some people, Democrats in positions of authority in their administrations, but they didn't change policy radically. So this is not about Democrats and Republicans, or independents or libertarians. It is. I want to see people in power who have a positive vision for North Carolina, for its future, not looking in their rearview mirror. So I want to disabuse anyone who thinks that I'm simply arguing for the Democrats. I'm not. And I can say some negative things about the Democratic Party, and I will.
Well, you do in your book.
So what would it look like? Let's take public schools. I am convinced that many of these people, they don't want to just change public. They want to get rid of public schools. They want public schools perhaps to exist for poor people and minorities, but they don't want their kids going to public schools. And they can imagine a world in which all the nice kids go to private schools or charter schools, which are also public schools, by the way, but they don't think of them as public schools. And so they don't think this would be a radical change. And they would live in their gated communities, and they would not be as familiar with what's they would not be familiar with what's happening to many of our unemployed citizens and to people who are struggling to get an education and get ahead. I wrote an article called Our Mean State. I think they are mean. They don't like poor people.
Are these wealthy people?
They're what?
Wealthy, rich people. Are these rich people?
Yes, by and large, I think that
they're
not
enough rich people to control state government, are they?
But listen, people have been asking for years, why do people vote against their own self-interest? And the people I certainly saw when I was running for office, people supporting my opponent who were on welfare, who were on Social Security, on Medicaid, and they were supporting a candidate who didn't support any of those things. I think the leadership, I would say, is often made up. The point has been made, and you can read innumerable North Carolina historians who argue that North Carolina has always been, if not run by, influenced by the plutocracy. The business plutocracy, specifically, starting with the land-owning plantation owners in the 18th century, then the textile mill owners, the tobacco mill owners, the furniture mill owners, and then the banks and the power companies were the power structure of North Carolina that ran the state. There's a mystery here. Because I would love to have anybody who can contribute to helping me solve this mystery. And I'm going to continue updating this book electronically. Jim Hunt did a masterful job of winning over the business plutocracy and convincing them that his vision of a progressive North Carolina had great benefits to them, that infrastructure and an educated workforce and a research triangle type society was good for business and that they should support it. He had a business roundtable. They met four times a year at various areas of the state, and he would sit down with them and talk about his program, listen to them, see what their ideas were. And so up until about 2008, the business community from, let's say, 1950 to 2008, supported the progressive ideas of the Jim Hunts and the Mike Easleys and the various governors that served during that time. Something happened in 2008, and the business community changed. And how I trace this is there used to be something called, remember North Carolina Citizens for Business and Industry, headed by Phil Kirk, who was also chairman of the Board of Public Instruction. They were supportive of the Hunt-type program and very supportive of education. In 2008, they dumped Phil Kirk, and they brought in a guy from Kansas as chairman of the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce. All emphasis on education dropped. The emphasis for the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce became low taxes and low regulation. And of course, well, you've got to have schools. But it was an afterthought. Why did they change? Who made that call that changed the business community and the—
And what's your answer to your question?
I don't have an answer. I don't know. That's why I'm saying I want help. And I've talked to, I was on North Carolina Citizens for Business and Industry, as were several other chancellors at that time. I don't know whether there are chancellors on the Chamber of Commerce, but I'd rather doubt it. What changed? I don't know the answer.
Well, let's take a break, okay. And we'll come back and try to find some answers to that. I'm visiting with Jim Lutze, a former chancellor at UNC Wilmington, former beloved professor here at Carolina. His book is Entering North Carolina, Set Clocks Back 100 Years. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our friend, Chapel Hill's friend, Jim Lutze. We knew him, I guess, most recently as the chancellor of an incredible University of North Carolina at Wilmington, where during his tenure, that school became a great competitor for some of the other universities in North Carolina for the affection of kids going to school. But we didn't come to talk about that, so we came to talk about his book. And this is a book about of history and about history as it relates to our current situation in North Carolina government and where we're going. Before the break, Jim, you said that what happened in 2008 is that the business leadership in the state took a different direction by hiring a new leader of its what became its Chamber of Commerce. And so I said, okay, well, tell me why. And you said he didn't know. But you know, well, a little bit. You have a theory about
okay.
that.
Okay. Obviously, some people were unhappy. And I think some people were unhappy that the Chamber, or that the Citizens for Business and Industry was so supportive of education, was spending a lot of its time supporting education, and sincerely believed that that was not necessarily the mission of the Chamber of Commerce and quote, the business community. The Chamber of Commerce is the business community. And so some people apparently decided that, particularly with a Phil Kirk, that there was too much emphasis on education. So they either, well, they must have made it, they went out and they found somebody from the state of Kansas, which is now, in fact, I think somebody wrote a book about whatever happened to the state of Kansas, which used to be a progressive state, actually. But it is now a very red state. Why did we go to a very red state and hire somebody? And I have, this is not meant personally. These people believe what they believe, and they sincerely believe what they believe. The only, I mean, this is too heavy, and I don't really think it's an answer, but it may be that some of them really want to engage the state in a social experiment to see what would happen if you turned the clock back 100 years. It's like Back to the Future or some. I don't think so. I publish in this book what's called the Powell Memorandum, written by Lewis Powell in 1971, in which he views the country as going socialistic and becoming an anti-free enterprise state. And he lays out a whole series of steps that need to be taken in order to stop the drift of the country towards socialism. When I ran, I was accused of being a socialist. I mean, that was a liberal college professor, socialist, blah, 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 blah. And I think many people feel that the country was going too far to the left. And frankly, and I don't think this had to do with a change of the business community in North Carolina, but I think the election of our first black president influenced a lot of people. They didn't like that. And I think they still don't like that.
Well, you deal with this and in a very thoughtful way in your book, but in 2008, many progressives thought that the election of a black president and North Carolina's support, that is, that he President Obama won the North Carolina electoral votes in 2008, that sort of demonstrated to the rest of the country that North Carolina was a special place in the South, and that it had moved past its, at least its racist past in some ways. You take issue with that as you look back and see some of the consequences of that election and the reaction to it in North Carolina.
I think the election of Barack Obama was like the gift bestowed by a bad fairy. In other words, it had negative consequences as far as the state was concerned. I try to make the point in this book that North Carolina, despite its progressive reputation, and I realize that for, I don't know, 4 or 5 million people in North Carolina have come here since 1960. And they thought North Carolina was what they thought when they crossed the border into North Carolina, that it was a Terry Sanford, JFK, progressive Jim Hunt state. But it had not always been. But even when the more forward-looking, what I view as the more forward-looking people were in power, there was always an undercurrent of racism and conservatism. And Jim Hunt and others had to be very careful how far they went, because they it was just beneath the surface, the basic conservative, not I wouldn't say the heart of North Carolina, but that part, that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde part of North Carolina. It used to be said that when Jesse Helms ran, he had 47% of the vote before the election was even held, because it was, and that may be a little exaggerated, but it's close. So when Obama was elected, and now you have, and I think many people, thoughtful people, although I'm sure that many people who voted haven't looked at the demographics. If they look at the demographics and see that by 2050, this country will no longer be a white country, that's very upsetting to them. And they could look and they could see this happening right in their own backyard. Good old North Carolina voting for, I view, by the way, Obama is a mixed race. He is not an African-American president. He's a mixed race president. But I think for many people, this was a fire bell in the night.
Mm. Jim Lutze, you've got so much experience in terms of working with the business community. You were the chancellor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, and lots of us would feel that if there is a conservative business community in North Carolina, it is in that arena. These are great people, but they have ideas that parallel some of the ideas that you skewer in your book. But you worked with them, I mean, in an incredibly positive way of finding common grounds in which you persuaded them to support the enterprise of what you might call socialized higher education, and the community rallied around you. So I'm a little bit surprised to see you go after these people so hard when you found a way to work with them when you were chancellor.
I'm not necessarily going after them hard. I mean, I think, again, an explanation of what happened. And I think after 2008, the business community took its eye off the ball. Now, there are changes. There have been changes in the business community. That is, a lot of our North Carolina-owned corporations and companies have now been taken over by out-of-state conglomerates like Wells Fargo Bank, for instance, and I have nothing against Wells Fargo Bank, but many many of these industries that were owned, our airlines, our banks, our power companies, and others, are now owned not by North Carolinians, or controlled not by North Carolinians, but people from out of state. And so I think, and also some business people told me that the business community has shortened its horizons, that now there's much more emphasis on profit and day-to-day profitability. Instead of having a long-range vision of where they want their corporation to go, they're under pressure to show a profit or to show forward movement in 3 or 4 years. And so their horizons have changed. So I think that there are some of those developments. I still have Republican friends, and I have Republican friends because I want to make the point. This isn't your grandfather's Republican. These are not Abraham Lincoln Republicans, and these are not, I don't know, Nelson Rockefeller. They're not even, I don't think, Richard.
And what about Barry Goldwater Republicans?
I don't, maybe in their excess of zeal, they are, what is it, excess in the defense of liberty is no vice or whatever. These are a different group of people. They think differently. And I think it's the emphasis, it is the combination of some conservative republicanism with a very healthy dose of libertarianism that is there. And then the Tea Party has an influence. The Tea Party's influential in North Carolina. And I think they reflect attitudes of the Tea Party. So there are a combination of reasons, but I'll say this, unless and until we win back the business community, there's not going to be a major change in North Carolina.
Well, let's talk some more about that after a break. Yeah. I'm visiting with Jim Lutze, the author of Entering North Carolina, Set Clocks Back 100 Years. He and I'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is former chancellor at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, Jim Lutze, well-known in Chapel Hill, a much-beloved teacher. Jim, I run into people all the time who say that sitting in your classroom, listening to your lectures were turning points in their lives. That's got to be even more satisfying than having run a university and run it well.
I love my former students, and I see them all over the place. And it's always great to see that they've been successful and that they felt that they learned something. So, yes, I'm very proud of my classroom time. I loved it, and I still love, and I still teach. I teach a class at UNCW.
Well, I'm thinking about driving down there and taking that class. That sounds great. No, I'm glad you did that. We're talking about your book and about the things you raise in your book, Entering North Carolina, and the subtitle, Set Clocks Back 100 Years. And you said, well, did you, let me talk about some of the specifics. Well, talk about the specifics.
Of course, the history is that Reconstruction lasted in North Carolina for a relatively short time, 1865 to 1871, 6 years. And then Governor Vance, who had been the governor during the Civil War, was re-elected. Ultimately, this state impeached Governor Holden, who had been the Reconstruction governor, shall we say, of North Carolina. So from 1871 until 1894, a group of people that called themselves the Redeemers, they were redeeming the state from the loss of the Civil War and the loss of the Southern values that had been lost at that time, and the things that they felt were positive about the Southern past. They held power until 1894, and in 1894, a coalition of, at that time, Republicans and populists. The people in power were Democrats. So, by the way, when we hear that the Republicans have not been in power for 125 years, that's a bunch of nonsense. They were in power, but they were called Democrats because they had the policies of today's Republicans. So the Republicans were in power. They were in power from 1871 until 1894, and then a group of people called the Populists and the Fusionists got together and threw them out. And they were out of power for the next 4 years. In the election of 1898, and Wilmington is the epicenter, in a sense, of this, a group of unhappy citizens with the way in which the election was going marched into the city hall and threw out the elected officials in Wilmington and replaced them with their chosen leaders, who were redeemers. These were people who, as I say, wanted to redeem the state from the horrors of Reconstruction and go back.
You say in your book that this is the only occasion in United States history when there was an armed coup d'etat which threw out a municipal government by force and succeeded in doing that.
That is correct. And part of that is because the country at large had lost interest in the Civil Rights Revolution or the Reconstruction policies and were not willing to send in federal troops or something else to reverse what had gone on. They drove many of the black population out of town. They put them on trains and sent them north. And there are still families in Philadelphia and other places that are the descendants of people that were driven out of Wilmington. And there were black citizens killed during the riot, which was both an economic, it's too complicated to go into, but it's political and economic. But the important thing is what came out of that, which was literally turning the clock back and changing the voting rules as far as black citizens were concerned to disenfranchise blacks. So the first thing they did was to change the North Carolina Constitution and put in grandfather clauses and other ways of disenfranchising blacks. Setting up voter regulations. Now you have to realize that North Carolina also was one of the latter states to get rid of land owning requirements for voters. North Carolina did not welcome women voting. That was not they in fact fought against the constitutional amendment that would allow women to vote. And it was not approved in North Carolina. It was not accepted. Now, women could vote after in the 1920 election, but in North Carolina. But North Carolina did not accept that amendment until 1971. And North Carolina disenfranchised Indian voters. And even though Indians served in the military in the Second World War, they couldn't vote in North Carolina until the mid-1950s. Voter registrars would simply not allow them to register and to vote. So North Carolina had low taxes. North Carolina had low regulations. North Carolina, and these were things that at that time the business community wanted. And the business community was not particularly interested in education at that time. Because if you educate people, you have to pay them more. And if you educate them, they may be agitators. So North Carolina, as I say, I can see many of the things that are going on today. There were no environmental rules and regulations in the 1920s and 30s. And it was the federal influence that they hated. I think in part because they thought back on Reconstruction and thought that that was awful. They didn't want federal interference. They wanted their independence. So I see a lot of what's going on now. And that's why I call these people redeemers, because I think they, again—
They want to take us all the way back, not just 10 years, but 100 or 150 years back.
100 years. Let's say
100. you have some suggestions about what can be done at the end of your book. You want to share with us some of the more important ones?
Well, we need to find a way to bring the business community back. I mean, I say we, whoever it is, whatever group or organization it is, we need to convince the business community. And there are progressive business leaders in North Carolina now. I mean, I certainly don't want to leave the impression that there are not. I mean, there are I don't want to name names, but everybody knows who some of the progressive leadership is. I'll say Jim Goodnight and Jim Goodman.
Just remember the good ones.
Right. Okay.
The good ones.
And the good gyms in this case. And so I think that all is not lost as far as the business community is concerned. And I think I look at some of this and say, hey, it isn't working. In 2010, Forbes magazine listed North Carolina as the third best place to do business. After all the, quote, business-friendly things that the legislature has done, North Carolina is now fourth as the best. It slipped a place. You look at unemployment. Unemployment in North Carolina is 6.7%. Nationally, it's 6.1%. If all these policies are wondrous for business and for the state of North Carolina, and people are earning less money than they were earning back 10, 20 years ago, the middle class is earning about what they were earning in the 1990s. So these policies aren't working, and the business community, I think, needs to be reminded that they're not working and reminded of when North Carolina was the Dixie Dynamo that we used to like to be, and living in North Carolina is like living in a dream. And so that's the kind of reputation that I want us to want. We have got to get... And this book is about, not about 2014, it's more about 2016 and 2020. I found when I ran that the Democratic Party was very poorly organized. They had become complacent. They thought that they were going to always win, and they didn't realize, I mentioned the Powell Memorandum, the Republicans, Jesse Helms and Art Pope, have been working since the 1970s. To bring about a Republican ascendancy, or to bring about the policy where we are now. So the Democratic Party has got to get itself organized. And I'm not sure they have the leadership right now that they need in order to do that. We need to convince, when I quoted the idea of why do people vote against their own best interest, why don't more people vote in their own interest? We're not going to turn out the young people, I don't think, in this election. And they are thereby being complicit in the policy. If you don't vote, then you don't have any reason to complain. So we have got to get larger voter turnout. We have got to change the rules as far as redistricting are concerned. We need a commission to do redistricting, not to do it politically. These maps that have been drawn by the people, by the redeemers and their friends, the map makers and the geopoliticians, are masterful in drawing people like Mike McIntyre out of his district. And I know members of the legislature where they drew lines around their house in their neighborhood and drew them out of their electoral district. So that has to be changed. We have to get rid of these rules, some of these restrictive rules on voter restriction.
Well, Jim Lutze, thanks so much for sharing with us. You're really only getting started, but you fired a first shot across the bow, and maybe that'll be the shot that we'll look back on as you look back at the Powell Memorandum. We'll look back 15 or 20 years from now and say, well, when Jim Lutze wrote his book, everything started to change. Now, I want to take a break, and then I want to come back, and I want to exploit your expertise in your global interest and your ideas about strategy to talk to us a little bit about what we might do in terms of what our country might do facing the challenges of today. Jim Lutze and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I got Jim Lutze to come to visit with us to talk about his new book, Entering North Carolina, Set Clocks Back 100 Years. But then I remembered that everywhere I go still, people in Chapel Hill and folks who've been to Chapel Hill talk about Jim Lutze as an incredibly interesting, provocative, and compelling teacher about in peace, war, and defense, not just about history, but about what you do when a nation's faced with unusual, tough challenges. And Jim, I hope I'm not springing this on you, but talk to us about how you move away from North Carolina for a minute and talk to us about the challenge that our country faces, that the president and the other political leaders in Washington face in terms of formulating a reaction to all of the things, not just for ISIS to Ukraine to China. We're living in a different world, aren't we?
We are living in a different world, and I think that basically the United States does not have a strategy and has not had a, quote, strategy, overarching strategy since the end of the Cold War. I think we sort of lost ourselves in celebrating after the Cold War. Books were written called The End of History and that capitalism had won and free enterprise was going to be the wave of the future and that we didn't need a military anymore and so on, so on, so on. And which I think that that euphoria blinded us to the fact that the world is still a very dangerous place. And we're now being pointedly reminded that the world is a very dangerous place. There's a difference between strategy and tactics, and I think we've been playing a tactical game. And I mean, a problem arises, and it's whack-a-mole, and bang, we just deal with this. I think we got ourselves overly enmeshed in the Middle East. I remember Condoleezza Rice saying that the challenge for the new generation of Americans was to bring democracy to the Middle East. I didn't realize we'd ever decided that was going to be our strategy. And I would say pack a lunch. I don't think you're going to bring democracy to the Middle East, to tell you the truth. I think that's overreach, and we're not going to do it. But I can say something. So I don't think we have a strategy. I think I don't think don't do stupid stuff, as Obama has said, is a strategy. I am disappointed that Obama seems, in a sense, more lawyerly and judicious than he is leaderly and willing to take charge. Now, I think his idea that we were going to have a shift to the Asiatic theater, that we were going to have to look to Asia rather than being so Eurocentric in our policies, I think that is correct. I think more of the future, we're going to continue to be major trading partners and major partners with Europe forever, I guess. But we're going to have to pay more attention to Asia because the rise of China is, unless it is directed in the right way, can be disturbing and alarming. And it many people in the Far East are disturbed and alarmed about the rise of China and the building of a Chinese Navy, which is the first sign of a desire to extend power beyond your borders. So I think we need a strategy. I don't have a strategy that I can lay out.
In terms of developing a strategy, what would be the optional consideration? What's the pathway, and what are some of the options, and who are some of the people that you would look to who have been thinking about this kind of strategy that you would want around the table if you were in charge?
Wesley Clark is just General Wesley Clark has just written a book which also points out and calls for the development of a national strategy, and it means people sitting down and really thinking about this, about what are our priorities, so that we don't become distracted by every issue that arises. For instance, somebody asked me, I was at a function last night, and somebody asked me, could I think of a historical analogy to ISIS? Was it like Nazi Germany, or what was the threat to the United States by ISIS? And I didn't mean to be totally facetious, but I said, maybe Canada. In other words, I don't see ISIS as a communist Nazi imperial Japanese threat to the United States. It's a regional threat, and I have to say, I still wonder about the whole concept that terrorism, well, I think terrorism is not our major problem, by the way, but anyhow, but that terrorists have to have a failed state in order to plan an attack on the United States. I said after 9/11, I think they could plan the attack on 9/11 at your neighborhood Holiday Inn. I mean, it doesn't take a country in order to plan an aerial attack on the United States such as was pulled off in 9/11. So I don't see ISIS as a threat.
Let me push you on this, because I'm interested in this, and this is a friendly question in the sense that I worry a little bit about the president's responding to the ISIS situation as vigorously as he has, while he's being criticized from the other direction.
Right.
But at a time when we need to devote our strengths to our very real challenges, that where we can make a difference, that we've proven over the last 15 years that we have a hard time, even with the application of all of our resources, to make a permanent difference, that some things, even when they go bad, you just have to let them go bad because the people around it have to take care of it.
I think you're absolutely correct. And I mean, and I asked my wife, I was just pondering some of these questions the other day, and I said, you know, I think back on the war in Vietnam, and people were asking, why are their Vietnamese better than our Vietnamese? Why are their Iraqi soldiers better than our Iraqi soldiers? There must be some real flaw in our training methods or something. But it is up to these people in this region. Now, my solution for ISIS, get Turkey involved. And I know the Turks aren't excited about this because they've fought the Kurds for years, and they see that helping ISIS will help the Kurds, and they don't want to do that. I think we ought to devote a lot of time and attention to getting the historical powers, and Turkey ran that part of the world for 400 plus years. And they want to play major player. I think we should find ways to try to induce Turkey to do it. Maybe we can't, but that would be certainly my choice before putting American troops on the boots on the ground. I think let's put some Turkish boots on the ground there and convince them that this is going to pay off for them in the long run.
We just got a minute, so break away from these specific things. And how do you see the United States? What is the future of the United States as a member of the world community during the next 15, 20 years and on into the future?
I think the United States is going to continue to be a power player, maybe not the sole power player that we enjoyed for a few years. But I'm concerned about the stability of the American economy. I mean, you can't be a world power if you're not a power within your own country. I'm worried about the gridlock in our government. And how can people look at the United States as an exemplar of democracy when we can't get anything passed out of our Congress, when we can't deal with our major problems because there's such partisan deadlock? So I think you have to get your own house in order first. I mean, we became a power in the post-World War II because we'd been a leader in the war, and people could look at that, and they could look at the country as a prosperous country and a working democracy. I'm worried we're not a working democracy anymore. I think people in the world are looking at us that way and saying, why should we follow their example when they can't seem to find a way to deal with problems like climate change or other major issues? I'm not sure that our financial institutions are as secure as they might be.
I wanted to end on an upbeat, but the time said we got to end on this little downbeat. I think you're still an optimist, and we'll bring you back to talk about these things in more detail later.
I am an optimist, and these are challenges.
They're challenges. We would want challenge. Optimists like challenges, and you're one of them, and wish we could run you for president. Jim Lutze has been my guest to talk about his book, Entering North Carolina, Set Clock Backs 100 Years. We hope we can get him back. Hope you'll come back, too. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.